Okay.
I also bought some leggings to make a pop filter, but I don't have any wire or anything.
A pot? What?
A pop filter for my mic.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Because this is like a
pop. Because I was thinking like soda, and I was like, "What the fuck is he filtering?" Are you saying pot? That sounds really out of character. I mean, he's been in California for like a week or two, so maybe.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, we have Richard Wally.
And from somewhere in Southern California, we have Cassidy Robinson.
Garden Grove.
Yeah, that's a place, I guess.
You should remember that, being the big Sublime fan that you are.
I actually do know that, but I didn't want you to admit that on air. I'm embarrassed of that time in my life.
You're embarrassed about your love of Sublime?
No, not really. I don't know. I like to lie sometimes.
Today we'll be reviewing a lot of movies. We're going to be reviewing Don John and Rush, two movies that we both wanted to see. We shelled out the extra $12 to $15, whatever it is now. And in our Netflix homework, we were supposed to review the movie Keyhole, but it has recently gone missing, disappeared off of the instant queue, so we had to make a last-minute change in arrangements, and we will be reviewing Upstream Color instead. If Keyhole ever pops back up, maybe it'll end up in the segment.
Maybe. I'm pissed now. I don't ever want to watch it again. Ever.
You're going to boycott it?
Yep. I hope Netflix feels good about themselves.
Well, so. How else will they learn?
No, that's true. I must boycott one movie on their old queue. That'll make them learn not to put it back on, I guess.
They are apparently... Maybe that's what happened.
Nobody was watching. No, that is actually, they do monitor that. They monitor a lot of things.
Yeah.
Your spending, what you do when you sleep. It's pretty intense.
Yeah, that and Xbox Live is taping us while we sleep.
That's just true. I was joking before. That little red robot eye that stares at you when you play the Xbox. That's not bullshit. You don't even have one, and I'm pretty sure it comes in your house at night.
Somehow, yeah. Like a floating robo orb above my bed, just videoing me.
Yeah.
Getting some grainy Paranormal Activity footage.
Yeah. Did you do anything with yourself this week?
No. Not really. I did have to go back to the DMV part 2 in my adventure. And I spent the better part of 3 or 4 hours, starting at 3 in the afternoon to about, no, I guess it was 2 hours, because I had to leave at 5, because that's when they were closing. And I was able to get my new registration and license plates. I will not be able to get a new driver's license until Tuesday, because they were closing and I didn't have enough time to go get it.
So this is going to be a segment for like a month?
Yeah.
You should just make it well, I hope it's not a continuing segment for you.
I hope not either. I'm really done.
Cassidy's 33rd adventure to the DMV.
That was my big adventure for the week. Kind of strange, though. On my way to go see Rush, a movie about Formula One racing and car crashes, I witness a car crash.
Oh.
A totally absurd and insanely violent-looking car crash. I was at a four-way stop, waiting for my green light, very calm roads. This is, like, literally not even a block away from where I live. And I was just sitting there waiting for the light to go green, and this car starts to turn into a lane, and all of a sudden this SUV, out of nowhere, going way too fast, just rams it into a stoplight and breaks the stoplight.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, and the whole front of the car was basically tore off, and the window was bashed in. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I should stay and be a witness, but I was going to miss a movie, so I left.
Shirking your responsibilities as a good citizen. That was the right move.
Yeah.
Like, really.
And, I mean, there were a lot of other people there. I don't think they needed me.
No, I'm sure. No, that's exciting.
It was very disturbing, though. I mean, I don't understand how that wreck happened, other than if the person was just not paying attention at all, which could be very possible, or he was literally trying to hit that person. Because it's not like the roads were busy and it was confusing. It was like the roads were clear and everybody was taking their turn, and he came out of nowhere and just rammed into this person.
Was the person in the car, though? A vehicle or no?
Yeah.
Okay, makes it a little...
I didn't witness a road murder.
That would be
I don't think I did. But
you may have, yes.
No, like they were turning into the other lane, and then mid turn this other car just came flying by 50 miles an hour and rammed it into a stoplight.
Yeah.
Life is a fragile thing, Richard.
Is that what you've got for me this week? Is that my life lesson?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. My captain.
What about you? What did you do?
What did I do? We went and saw, at one part of this week, we went to the Hollywood Theater. Nice big, this is part two of my trips to the Hollywood Theater.
Uh-huh.
We saw basically they put a bunch of old Grindhouse trailers together and showed them.
Fun.
Yeah, no, it was kind of like from the
Quentin Robert Rodriguez movie. And
Quentin Tarantino. Kind of like that, except for real ones from the 70s.
Yeah.
There were such titles as Werewolves on Wheels, which is about motorcycle gangs that turn into werewolves.
Naturally.
Yeah, that was pretty. That one I was pretty excited about.
Mm-hmm.
There's also one about Bruce Lee coming back from the dead and fighting people.
As you do.
Yeah. So there's also lots of boobies and other fun stuff like that. So, you know, just good wholesome fun.
Yeah,
for the whole family.
They actually sell those in compilations now. You can go to like Best Buy sometimes, and they'll have those like trailer compilations that you can buy for like $5 to $10.
No, I think they this one they made on their own.
Yeah.
It's like a thing they do, which is a pretty cool thing to do, I guess.
Off of a bunch of old prints they had or something.
Yeah, because it was all, I believe it was all 35 millimeter even. So, kind of weird, right?
Yeah. How long was the presentation?
Hour and something.
So practically like a feature-length film.
Yeah. It was like a very strange... Well, it was good because they cut out all the crap that, you know, sometimes you'll sit down to an exploitation film and be bored, like really, really bored, except for those, you know, you can see the trailer and the trailer's great. And then it's just like regular movies.
All right. Well, we'll just go on now and get into our movie news before we run out of things to talk about, or before I complain even more about the DMV. Which I could do, but I won't.
You should. No, please don't. I'm sick of it already.
As am I. So, what is the first bit of news you have for us?
The first bit of news. DC trying to catch up with Marvel still, or so it seems. Maybe not. They're putting into production a Constantine movie. I guess they've weighed their options, and this is one of the best ways they've decided they should adapt the character.
Constantine movie?
Constantine, Constantine the comic book character.
Yeah.
So I'm going to assume he's going to be blonde and British this time.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume, maybe not, though. No, I'm curious to see where they go with that. I don't really see it as a property being... It seems like they want to bring it to, like, NBC or one of the normal studios, and that seems strange to me. If you're going to do that, it seems like it would be... Because it's normally it's a Vertigo title.
Yeah.
And so you would think that they would bring it to, I mean, at the least, like, an AMC or so a TNT or something like that.
This is a TV show.
Yeah, TV show.
You said movie earlier.
Did I?
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
No. Before they were talking about it, because they were talking about the Dark Avengers. I think that I didn't... connect all of that. That's my bad. They were kind of weighing the different options, and they're doing, yes, a TV as opposed to a feature length.
Yeah, I mean,
presentation.
I think it would work fine as a serialized show. I mean, Hellblazer, the comic that Constantine comes out of, is one of the longest running Vertigo titles, if not the longest.
No, agreed on that point. I just guess, I don't know, I just don't see it as a, you know, one of the big four.
Major network.
Yeah, I don't see them as being on Fox or ABC or, in this case, NBC.
Yeah, well, what is American Horror Story run out of? Is that FX?
Yeah, that's FX as well.
Okay, so that's a cable network as well. Yeah. I don't know. Horror television is kind of a thing now.
I'm not complaining.
I mean,
it's been decent at least.
Dexter just had their final episode. And Bates Motel is getting fairly good reviews. The Hannibal show is getting fairly good reviews. American Horror Story is fairly popular. So I could definitely see a Constantine show being possible in this day and age. How much it decides to connect to the DC universe, I don't know. How much they want to edge towards horror or edge towards crime drama, I don't really know. It probably depends on their budget.
My main thing was, is I remember when they were talking specifically, and this is why the confusion came up, because when I was talking about this, I was also thinking about the Dark Avengers that Del Toro was talking about at one point.
That he teased.
Yeah. What did I say? Did I say the Dark Avengers?
You mean
I meant the Dark Justice League.
You're struggling.
Man, I am struggling.
You have a cold or something, right?
Oh yeah. My wife, that's what she's been sick, and so we're just doing the pass it along game.
That's a fun game.
Yeah, you know.
It's like apples to apples, but you know, with more mucus.
Yeah, and people are, you know, usually not as happy to get it, so.
Uh-uh. It's not a game you want to win.
No, I won, though. I won.
Yeah, we'll see what NBC does with this. Obviously, you know, there has been a Constantine movie with Keanu Reeves, however many years ago it was now, probably something like 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's disregarded enough, kind of deleted from the, I don't know, pop culture
zeitgeist,
if you will. So I think they can come in fresh, and I don't think people are going to be upset that it doesn't follow that movie's canon.
No, agreed. I just don't know what they're going to do with it specifically. Also, I mean, you just have a plethora of other things. Like, if they're going to do that show, you know, I just don't see it on a major cable because they do Supernatural already. And so for me, the show would have to get into the even darker subject matter to really be... I guess, relevant.
Yes.
But I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Well, that's not the only television show that is trying to get started out of the DC universe. Probably even more so inspired by the new S.H.I.E.L.D. television show head by Joss Whedon. Fox is in talks to do a Batman-inspired series called Gotham that takes place in the Gotham PD universe, with probably very little to no Batman involvement. Which isn't unheard of. I think people, you know, the uninitiated non-comic book reading people have probably heard this news and said, what? Gotham without Batman? What's the point? But, in the comic books, as you know, there's been many, different titles about, you know, the peripheral characters of the DC universe and specifically within the Batman universe and kind of turning his city into sort of a crime drama show.
And Gotham Central.
Gotham Central, GCPD, which were both really good titles and sold pretty well. And I think there's a lot of great stories that can be written there. I think actually this, to some extent, would probably lend itself to TV even easier than S.H.I.E.L.D., depending on, you know, who they get to write and run this thing.
Yeah, no, Gotham Central is really great. It was really funny seeing normal cops up against supervillains.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not really funny. It was just kind of a interesting difference, juxtaposition, Batman versus supervillains versus regular cops versus supervillains.
The stakes are higher, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, and they die a lot quicker.
Yeah, which I mean, exactly, so you could actually, you know, put a lot of drama into a show like that. I mean, it depends on how, I wonder, like, you know, how campy they're going to allow the show to get, because, I mean, some of those characters aren't, it's going to be sort of hard to take seriously. You know, I mean, to see something like Harley Quinn or Poison Ivy in a show about cops.
Well, what's the direction they're going and how they're going about it?
Yeah.
I don't think it necessarily has to be campy. I think sometimes it does. It is a little hard to adapt some of the flamboyant costumes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the basic ideas, you know, aren't that hard to adapt.
Yeah. So certainly the way that they interpret everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously in the Nolan universe that is wildly successful, a cop drama within that kind of universe is very plausible.
Right, right. So
those movies were kind of halfway there anyway.
Yeah, they were definitely edging there. So.
Yeah. Well, fun. What's your other piece of news?
My other piece of news recently just popped up. So Neil Blomkamp's been, after this year's Elysium, he's already had what he was going to move on to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's apparently some kind of like comedy, sci-fi, drama thing, named Chappie.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first, they've already been, there's been several people, Charlton Copley is definitely going to be in it. They've also suggested Dave Patel, but news just broke that, Hugh Jackman, he actually posted that I'm doing a role in Neil's new film called Chappie, which we shoot in Johannesburg. I'm there for a couple of weeks at the beginning of next year.
Hmm.
So,
isn't there already a release date for that?
It's, March 27th, 2015.
Yeah, so a year, but pretty much a year. That's exciting. I read the plot synopsis a little bit. Criminals steal a robot.
Yeah. An AI, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they still a robot that has AI. I don't know. It's one of them sci-fi thingies.
Yeah, he seems to like that. It'll be interesting to see how this movie turns out, given the mixed response to Elysium.
Well, at first I was like, it's Short Circuit, right?
Yeah.
No. Hey. That's one of my kid movies. Like, I love Short Circuit.
No, I'm all about it. Don't even think I'm not. that was a laugh of joy.
Oh, okay.
My other news item.
Judging.
My other news item here is Jennifer Lawrence has just been cast in a remake of Ilya Kazan's East of Eden, this time directed by Hunger Games director Gary Ross. So there's that.
Yeah. Don't have a lot to say. His last movie I thought was kind of poopy, so.
True, but I don't think that he himself is a bad director. I think that I feel like he was kind of dealt a shitty hand, with that production. I felt like I don't think he really had a lot of say in what that movie got to be, and nor that I think he was terribly interested in what it was going to be. Because if you look at his other films, like Seabiscuit or Pleasantville, they're a lot more stylish and a lot more, he has a lot more of a vision for them. So hopefully this turns out a little bit better. I just actually recently saw the original East of Eden, which is a great film. I mean, it's like really good. Starring, James Dean. So, I don't necessarily, again, like most of these, I don't really think there needs to be a remake. I think I'm really fine with there not being one. But I don't know. It's interesting that this is his choice right after deciding not to do the sequel to one of the most popular, you know, out of the gate franchises ever. Definitely shows more what he's interested in.
Right. Well, I mean, good luck to him, really, but yeah, I don't know. It doesn't spark much for me because there is the original film, so
yeah.
I'm just kind of like, okay,
yeah,
I'll go watch that one. So,
all right, I think that's it for our news, isn't it?
That would be all of it, yes.
Okay, which means it is time for the pet topic, and it is my turn. I was kind of going around this in my head a little bit, what I wanted to ask, what I wanted to discuss. We don't have to go into this too much because we do have a lot of other things to talk about. But I was interested specifically because we'll be reviewing the movie Don John, which has a lot to do with, pornography and porn addiction. I was interested in that subject, and it got me thinking about it in a certain time in film history, a very short-lived time in film history where the world of pornography and the world of legitimate cinema was not too far apart. When movies like Deep Throat and Suddenly Sweet Susan were actually big box office draws in their cities, and normal people, quote-unquote, were going to see them as like date movies, even though it was hardcore pornography, but they, you know, they still kind of had plots and they had their stable of actors and blah, 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 blah. Then around, you know, if you've seen Boogie Nights, pretty much covers all this, but then, once the advent of video comes, it shuts down all of those, porno theaters and the productions get a lot cheaper and it starts to become more about, you know, money shots and fake boobs and you just getting to the point, you know, enough with the plot kind of stuff. And pornography has become increasingly more and more about instant gratification and less about even a semblance of storytelling. My question was, do you think that it could be possible for the two genres, to ever legitimately cross paths or, you know, a type of narrative pornography to be legitimized, or dare I say even artistic? Do you think that's a possibility, or do you think as soon as you enter into the realm of titillation, you're immediately going somewhere else?
I think practically, I don't think it will happen, or at least not for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But is it possible? Yeah, I mean, we did kind of get an entry. I didn't see it, but Short Bus.
Sure.
Yeah. They kind of played with, real couples having real sex and all that kind of jazz.
Uh-huh. That was a musical, no less.
Right. it's not, like I said, I don't see it going that way just because of what it's been, in the last, you know, 30 years.
Yeah.
And especially, I think it's just gotten worse and worse.
Yeah, with the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just besides the internet too, like, and I know here in, or actually not here, but in Seattle, they do like the Hump Festival.
Uh huh.
And so I know that they play around with those notions, but I don't see it ever being that viable, like, honestly.
But the interesting thing is, because of the internet, more people are exposed to pornography than ever before, and more easily and readily accessible. So if you think about it, if a quote-unquote legitimate film or a narrative film wanted to go to those waters, at least as a way of accentuating certain things or making something more realistic or what have you, you would think that the transition should be easier for modern-day audiences, or do you think that people would be taken out of the movie as soon as it started?
It's definitely more easy now than mid-90s or sometime like that.
Yeah.
I just don't see it as a full transitional thing as of now. I mean, things can change. I don't know. I can only speculate on some of what we've already seen, such as like that director. What's his name from Ocean's movies and Haywire? And
oh, Steven Soderbergh.
There we go. Steven Soderbergh. Yeah. Him doing the film with that one porn star.
Sasha Grey, the Girlfriend Experience?
Yes, yeah. That's the one.
But there's no actual pornography. There's no actual pornography in the movie. I mean, as I recall, I don't even think there's a nude scene. I mean, I think might be, like, you know, scantily clad at some points, but...
Yeah. I was just about to say, I haven't seen the film, so I don't know how much pornography is actually, but... I do know by using the actress, he's invoking a certain...
Sure.
And trying to maybe somewhat tap into a certain crowd.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's plausible. I don't see it as happening...
anytime soon.
Soon.
Well,
I think that it's degraded into a lot of like cheap, easy titillation that you can jerk your girt to while you're at your home for a good 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Dads can squeeze in between whatever. I don't know. Maybe probably wives too. I don't know.
Sure. Well, look at the whole, you know, 50 Shades of Grey revolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's porn. I don't care what you call it.
No, it is. It totally is. But I think, I mean, we'll talk about it because the movie kind of brings that up, but. There are different forms of pornography.
Yes.
Some people just, I mean, pornography in general, it's not reality. It's fantasy.
Uh-huh. But think about that. Like, think if, I mean, cause obviously right now we could care less about a 50 Shades of Grey movie, which is going forward.
Sure.
It's been cast. We've talked about it on the podcast. And obviously it's not going to be pornography. It's not going to be, there's no way it could even be what it wants to be.
Have they already, haven't they already said it's going to be PG-13 or something?
Oh, I don't think it's going to be PG-13, but I'm sure it'll be R and probably a light R. But imagine if that movie was an NC-17. Imagine if you got an interesting director who really wanted to subvert that material. That would be interesting to me. You know,
it could be
that a film could both be narrative and legitimate and pornography all at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I see, because a film just inherently about sexuality doesn't necessarily have to be pornography. That's where I get kind of, I guess, mixed up in this, is even if it is like we see full penetration and all that jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Like you see full penetration in Antichrist, but I wouldn't typify that as pornography.
At least not for you. It's somebody's pornography.
Well, that's fair. I don't know if I want to go that route, though.
Somebody could be really into drilling holes in the legs and all of that.
Thank you for that.
I mean, yeah, there has been films fairly recently that has employed a pornographic sensibility or, you know, a certain kind of graphicness, Antichrist being one of them, the film The Brown Bunny, which ends with Chloe Sevigny giving Vincent Gallo, the director, and at her time, her boyfriend, a real blowjob. And Short Bus, as you've already mentioned, which really actually does kind of skirt that line. I mean, I think there's sequences in there that are for the intention of titillation and nothing else. But like I said, it's a musical also, and it's, you know, done by a legitimate filmmaker.
Well, I think, see, this is the point where when it becomes just titillation,
yeah,
that's when to me it kind of skirts away from being legitimate.
Yeah.
And it's really hard not to do that because you are talking about, you know, something that is just purely titillation at a point in your mind. So it's a difficult subject and it's hard to kind of get at.
Yeah.
Because there are ways of exploring, you know, there's several directors that have been doing it since the 70s that have been exploring sexuality without having to, you know, actually go hardcore.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, so there is kind of a dilemma there, but I don't. It's one of those things where it's like, how are they using it and is it a meaningful way?
Yeah.
Is kind of where I get to with it, but.
All right. Well, we'll move on now to our reviews for the week. And we might as well start with Don John since, we're already on the subject. So do you want to set that up or I can?
I'll set it up.
Okay.
Doesn't really matter. Don John is basically about a young man named John, who they call Don because he's such a strapping young man. And he basically he lives a very,
hedonistic,
simple lifestyle. Yeah, hedonistic, simple lifestyle. Well, I wouldn't say he's hedonistic. He just does it a lot because, I mean, he does go to church. So that's, you know, isn't that supposed to be? Like, isn't that supposed to save your soul or whatever?
Or something.
Or something, right? But, you know, he talks about his family, his friends, and his porn. He loves his porn. And so basically, he goes on this journey by getting in a relationship with Scarlett Johansson and finding out that maybe he doesn't have the right stuff to be in a real relationship just because he's always based it off of his ideas. That have been developed through of sexuality through pornography, and that's basically. I mean, the film is kind of like an anti-romantic comedy almost,
mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, which is good. It has some great performances, I think, from Scarlett Johansson,
mm-hmm.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Julianne Moore.
Yeah. And it's all. This is also the directing and writing debut from Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Correct. Overall, I mean, it was a pretty good film. It did seem like a first-time director to me. There is a little some awkwardness, and not just directing. I think writing too.
Yeah.
I felt like the first half. I get what they were trying to. I get with all the babies and the different things that he was trying to, them saying the word baby.
Oh, like, okay. Yeah.
Like the physical word, like baby, like that.
Yeah.
I get what he was trying to evoke with it, but it didn't work. He needed to change his vernacular a little bit just to give us some variation. I was about to, die in that, but what was good about it was, I think that there was a good handful of it that was shot fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that there was a real, hurrah to try to really make the film about something.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely has a persuasive, argument behind its purpose.
Yeah. And I think that it mostly works.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the film for the most part, but it did seem like a novice or first-time director's film.
Yeah.
Definitely in pacing and in writing.
I thought the pacing was fine for the most part. It never felt like it dragged. But I do agree that it did feel very much like a first-time director in that it's very aggressive. Everything about the movie.
Well, let me put it this way. I thought the first, a big part of the first part of the movie drug a bit. And I believe that the last half was very successful, actually.
Hmm. It's actually funny because I feel similar but opposite. I have more problems with the last half of the movie, and it's not anything technical with the film, it's thematic that I run issue with.
But
like you said, it feels very much like a first-time director because it is very aggressive. He's using every, you know, bell and whistle. You know, there's a lot of voiceover, mm-hmm. and in a way some of the writing is a little self-indulgent. The editing is very kind of fast, has kind of a hip-hop editing, especially through the first half of the movie, which surprises me that you think that's where it drags, because I feel like it's really trying to move it along.
I think that's kind of why, is because it was just all bells and whistles to me, and it didn't really move along.
Yeah. Well, you get that he's setting up his argument for...
It seemed more clumsy in the beginning, where it seems like he got a lot more of his footing at the end to me.
So. Well, it certainly gets more traditionally presented by the second half of the movie, where it starts to settle a little bit more, and as his character's making his transition, the film sort of calms down as well. I thought that was fairly intentional, though. But my issue with the movie is that I feel like there's a little bit of thematic hypocrisy going on with the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character and with what the message of the movie is trying to say, because it really seems to demonize the world of pornography and specifically this character's enjoyment of it. And the way it seems to do that, or how Joseph Gordon-Levitt does it, both with his performance and with the way that he writes the character, is that the character is very broad. All the characters, for the most part, except for maybe the Julianne Moore character, all the characters are pretty broad. And they don't really have a lot of dimension to them. Even when he makes his transition, it feels a little too pat. It feels a little too like, oh, so you mean there's more to life than this?
Sure.
And all of a sudden, you know, something that I think's fairly obvious, becomes this big life-changing moment for him. Also, the movie seems really strangely adverse to, specificity. We know that he has a job. We never actually see him do it, and we never really find out what it is.
Oh, no, he's a bartender.
He says that. We never actually see him do it.
But the first movie, yeah.
But we see him do...
It's for a brief second. It's not long, okay. But you do see him do it.
But for a person, even living in New Jersey, and he's like this sort of Jersey Shore Guido type, even for a person in New Jersey, his apartment is way too nice for the service industry.
Agreed.
That's just a thing. But
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be argue with you. I just read an article about a guy that made $80,000
bartending.
He got his BA and couldn't make money at an office job like that, so he took a bartending job and made $80,000.
Okay. I'm going to assume that's the
the
exception to the rule.
So,
yeah. I didn't dislike this movie, though. I thought it was perfectly entertaining, but I did think that the other half of this, the argument that he makes here, which I think is a slightly better argument, is everything that happens with the girlfriend character played by Scarlett Johansson. He also makes the argument that, yes, men have unrealistic expectations when it comes to sex, but that some women, not all women, but some women have unrealistic expectations when it comes to being in a relationship. They have a fantasy version of a relationship that is almost impossible to meet. And I thought that was a slightly more persuasive argument, but it kind of gets undercut once, and I'm not going to spoil it, something happens towards the end of the movie that I didn't buy for a second.
Okay, I don't know what you're talking about, so we'll have to talk.
It involves a tertiary character.
Okay. I think I know. Maybe. We'll see.
There's a certain character who comes midway through the movie who's very instrumental in the character's change, which was fine. I was okay with that. But then
sure.
When, you know, it makes this big argument against, you know, the quote-unquote Nora Ephron-style romantic comedy, I feel like by the end of the movie, it still kind of becomes that.
In a lot of ways, yes. It more or less does. I mean, they make it a habit to be like, oh, we're not going to get married, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
We're just in it for right now or whatever. And, you know, I mean, I mostly agree with everything you said. I just think that the movie itself is a little clumsy. It doesn't deliver this message as well I don't think that there are parts of it that, I agree with you that I don't think that there are parts of it that are as profound as it
thinks it is.
Kind of wants to be. Mm.
I think,
but it's perfectly, yeah, it's an entertaining film.
Yeah, and I think it's consistently funny.
I think it's fairly funny, yeah.
And I think it has a lot of style, and it certainly moves along, and it's as for a first time effort, it shows promise. It's not a complete mess. Yeah. It's just, I feel a little thin.
No, it's a, like I said, I think that you can definitely tell it's from a first time film director.
Yeah.
I guess what kind of my question is do you think that the, how am I going to put this? So do you think that the pornography thing completely falls flat? Cause see, some of the things that I found that fell flat was like, I didn't buy the whole Guido lifestyle thing from any of the characters.
I would have bought his character, honestly, and this might be actor turned director thing. I would have maybe bought the character if he wasn't playing it. I don't think that he did a bad job with the character, but it's in knowing that he wrote the material for himself to do, you start to get like, you know, like he purposely wrote a character that he wanted to be very different from what he normally plays. Sure. Which he has a pretty broad career, so to say what he normally plays is kind of hard to say, but it feels very much like he's acting a lot in the movie, and it's hard to not see that. Whereas if he had cast like a Channing Tatum or something, it would have been a little easier to just kind of go with the flow.
Yeah, apparently that was, at one point that was his choice to play.
Yeah, or a Mark Wahlberg, which, you know.
Yeah. Well, it seemed a little patched, and it seemed like a lot of the people who were in the film, who are this like Guido-esque whatever thing that was going on,
yeah,
didn't really... I don't know. It seemed more like a TV stereotype.
A little bit. I thought Tony Danza was surprisingly watchable.
No, I thought he was very entertaining.
I thought he was entertaining in it. I really liked. I actually really liked Scarlett Johansson's portrayal in this.
I did as well. I just didn't buy. I didn't buy any of their characters.
Yeah, they felt
as this specific. It just seemed so stereotypical that I was just like, okay.
A little bit like an SNL skit sometimes.
Most of the time, yes. No, I liked her performance, and I thought I did enjoy the fact that they did do the whole like turnaround. You said that. My bad. You said that you really liked the fact that she used these romantic films as like her own sort of pornography.
Yeah. Well, it goes into more than just that. There's one pivotal scene, probably the best scene in the movie, where it has nothing to do with pornography, where she freaks out on him for a very minor and weird thing. It has to do with him just wanting to buy cleaning supplies because he kind of comes from a privileged lifestyle.
Yeah.
And to me, that was the biggest red flag more than anything. You know. Yeah. Way more than the fact that she, you know, freaks out when she catches him with porn. I mean, that's somewhat understandable, but maybe not to the extent that she goes. But when she freaked out over that, to me, that was the most telling thing about that character.
Agreed. No, that was a very good scene in retrospect. I actually tended to kind of gloss over it. I was so distracted by the Guido-ness of it. No, I'm serious. It was a really big stumbling block for me.
You felt that the performances film. Were just a little too affected?
They were stilted, yeah. Yeah. Completely.
And we can move on after this, but I was just going to see what you thought about it. I felt like there was an issue with, and this kind of goes back to my pet topic question, there was an issue where, you know, and as the way that the film is edited, it cross-cuts where he's doing this voiceover and he's talking about why pornography does it for him more than actual sex with a real person. But I felt like there was something kind of weird and not working when the women that he's bringing home are essentially porn stars. Like, they're these gorgeous, unrealistically beautiful women, and then it's cross-cutting from that to porn that can't really be porn because it's in an R-rated movie.
Well, I think the point was that it didn't live up to the fantasy.
No, I got
what it was.
I definitely got what he was going for. I got the point of that juxtaposition, but I felt like it wasn't working because the women he picked to be in the quote unquote real world were way too attractive.
He's a fairly attractive fellow, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he could pull that, but, but also the pornography that they're cross-cutting it with, you know, the real sex versus the pornography sex, has to be edited to be in an R-rated movie. So to me, it's like the cross-cutting from one scene that looks exactly like to the other one. Like, it makes the argument right. A little weaker.
I know that apparently, because I actually, I think I did wonder this question, but maybe in a different, like, framework.
Mm-hmm.
Because I looked, I wanted to know, like, if there was a different version.
Yeah, I would imagine this film probably got hacked to pieces.
At Sundance, there was, there was full pornography in it. They cut it down to make it more of an R-rated.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there could be a very, I think I know what you're getting at, and I think maybe you're right, but I don't necessarily think it would have, I don't think it would have, added that much to it.
Yeah. Well,
honestly, I mean, maybe more to the message, like you're saying,
yeah.
Maybe, but I think that all these other distractions and just maybe partially, I'm trying to figure out, I'm kind of struggling because some of the parts that I enjoyed, I also felt like maybe didn't serve the movie.
Okay.
So I kind of liked the message of the movie is like, you know, you have to get out of this fantasy of what romance is.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like some of it just didn't maybe necessarily serve, the plot as much. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm still kind of trying to wrap my head around some of the faults.
Yeah, it is kind of tough to put your finger on, but I feel like a lot of it has to do with, for me, the ending and this, the way that it has to sort of walk on eggshells with the subject matter.
I just thought it was, I think for me, what I chalked it up to anyways was just the clumsiness of it.
Okay. Well, yeah, certainly maybe in a more capable hands, some of these delicate issues could be ironed out a little better.
Yeah. Anyways, we need to
move on.
Yeah.
Because we're in a rush.
We're in a rush to get to our next film, which is...
We're going to podcast hell for that joke, by the way.
I know. It was a bad one. It was a really bad one. I'd like to apologize on behalf of both of us.
All right, what are we moving on to?
Do we really have to say you're going to hell twice for that one? Buddy.
Oh, I guess I'm setting this one up, aren't I? We will be reviewing the film Rush by Ron Howard. This is his most current film, and it stars Chris Hemsworth, aka Thor from the Marvel Universe. This is his kind of his first real legitimate big prestige film. And it
yes.
has to do with a true to life, based on a true story, about a Formula One racer in the 1970s from England, named James Hunt. But as he tells everybody when he introduces himself, he's Hunt. James Hunt. With a very suave British accent that he has in this movie. And he's kind of a womanizer, and he's, you know, sort of a man of the world. He has an arch nemesis who's kind of a creepy German. This is a James Bond movie with cars, is what I'm getting at. At one point, the German becomes disfigured.
I never put all of that together, but okay, keep going. I like where it's going.
I feel like the whole movie was kind of an audition reel for him to be the next James Bond. But it is a fairly serious film to some degree. He's a Formula One racer who is a womanizer, and he doesn't take life too seriously. At one point, he gets married to Olivia Wilde just because he knows he can, not because he really cares. They eventually split up. But he has this rivalry with this man named Niki Lauda, an Austrian Formula One racer who comes from a family of wealth. He sort of buys his way into it rather than winning his way up. But he is very talented as well behind the wheel. He's played by Daniel Brühl, I think is how you say his name. There's umlauts.
Brühl, I think it is. Yeah. I think you're Brühl, the R Brühl, or something.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. Yeah, it's kind of about the friendly competition, or the not so friendly competition between these two, and how they come from, you know, different sort of philosophical backgrounds, when it comes to professional, manner and how they carry themselves. One, you know, Hemsworth's character is a lot more kind of reckless and live fast, die young, leave a good looking corpse, whereas, Niki Lauda is, you know, a little bit more studied and a little bit, you know, maybe has to do with the fact that he paid his way in. He kind of wants to win with, you know, by the book rules. And the movie's not really a lot, about a whole much more than that. It's kind of your basic sports movie setup. You see these two, go toe to toe on the road, if you will. It kind of builds, specifically with this, with the car accident that happens about midway through, it kind of builds this emotional, thread within the movie. And you see how they, even though they hated each other at the beginning, how maybe they learned they're not so different. What did you think of Rush?
I personally found, it was funny because I kind of talked about this before we talked, but, I found it interesting to watch Don John and then watch this. Mm-hmm. So a first time director versus a more vetted director.
Yeah.
And I feel like that this film is a much more consistent mm-hmm. film. And I also, the other thing is it is about a subject that I don't really have a whole lot of, interest in.
Mm-hmm.
But I was interested during the movie. So that is always a pleasant surprise.
Yes.
To me, it was a character study movie.
Yeah.
That kind of had a dualistic kind of like bouncing off of each other. But I did find it funny that this self-assured rock star kind of, you know, character, he was always so nervous before and would throw up. And then he would just say, oh, it just means, you know, he'd shake it off cavalierly. But he was always playing with his lighter and always, you know, there was a real,
anxiety,
a real, besides anxiety, just a real like, insecurity okay. behind a lot of what he did.
Sure.
Whereas, it was this weird, like, mirror image because where you got somebody who probably should be insecure wasn't at all because he's basically like, this fucking doesn't matter, this doesn't matter, this doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is this is what I'm doing and I'm gonna win.
Yeah.
And so you got a true confidence versus kind of the cavalier confidence.
Yeah.
And you know what? I personally, yeah, the film didn't have a whole lot more than the character study aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
but I found it, the pacing was very deliberate.
Yeah.
I liked the interjecting of the, like, machine parts moving,
uh-huh.
interjected with the drama, because it really, and the speed of the film, which may sound kind of silly, but it really did, by having it kind of race along in a sort of fashion, it really did give the movie a drive.
How many more car metaphors do you want to use?
I was planning on using all I could think of.
Okay. No, I agree with you. I actually, you know, I just basically walked out of this thing not very long ago, so I haven't had a ton of time to kind of think on it, but it is very serviceable. It's very good. I mean, you know, it's hard to fault this thing. It kind of does everything that it's trying to do just fine. I can't say that I was terribly excited by much of it, only because I don't really care about the subject matter, and only because okay. I don't feel that there's a ton of layers going on in the actual story stuff, other than, like you said, a character study about who these people are and their egos and their, you know, challenging masculinities.
Has to be like... Yeah, I just don't feel like it always has to be more than
that. It doesn't.
Like, it always has to have an underlying...
In the sports movie tradition, I think it follows along that pretty fine. But it is done with a very assured, studied hand. Mm-hmm. And Ron Howard, who we were joking before this came on, one of his first films was a racing film he did for the Roger Corman factory called Grand Theft Auto. No relation to the video game, I don't think. And then, so you're kind of coming back to this subject matter again in a completely different way. But I like the way the movie looks a lot. It's very, the production design of it and sort of the world that he establishes, you know, being a period piece in the 70s, feels very kind of like a late 70s up through even the 80s type of sports movie that you, or even just a movie that you don't see. It would be very easy to take this material and make a PG movie with it. And he deliberately chooses not to. And the world feels lived in. It feels real. The characters, the way, you know, their dress, practically everybody smokes, which you almost never see in movies anymore.
Right. I didn't even think about that, but you're right.
And it kind of reminds me of the type of movies you would have seen, like, back in the days of, like, Hoosiers. A slightly more melancholic sports movie. So I did enjoy it. I think it's a well-made, well-crafted, finely tuned, if you will.
Well, I think also, movie. I think something that really, something that was really delivered as well is the performances.
The performances, obviously, yeah.
I thought that Chris Hemsworth and Daniel Buell were both really excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Buell is one of those actors, too, that I felt he kind of got left behind in the Inglourious Bastards kind of realm. But I think he was great in that film, too. But I think he really kind of showed his chops a little bit more in this film. And Chris Hemsworth, I mean, we already knew that he could, you know,
do it,
could lead a film. But this is just another facet of him being like, oh, now I'm in kind of a more of a prestigious movie, and I'm just as good, just as convincing. And, you know, he doesn't feel like a fucking, a little bit. He is kind of, I guess, a golden god in kind of like the rock star sense. But he's not, and maybe that was purposeful
casting,
but I don't think that, but I think that he plays it well, and I think that it makes sense, and it really works, and I think he really delivers a great performance.
No, he does. I think he is the real deal. I think he's, you know, kind of an old-style movie star, and I think he's going to be successful, and you know, it's crazy to think that not very long ago, this guy was completely unknown,
mm-hmm.
and it was being in a comic book movie that got him to be in, you know, a Ron Howard picture.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, before that too, the first like couple Hollywood films like Red Dawn and Cabin in the Woods were both shelved for so long.
Yeah, so he kind of had, you know, his career sort of had a halt for a while. But yeah, it's really taken off, and I think he totally deserves it. I think everybody looks good in this movie. Everybody comes off really well. Even Olivia Wilde, who is an actress that...
You mean the lesser Emily Blunt?
I think
that's I'm sorry, that's terrible, but that's kind of how I always see it.
Unfortunately, that's what she's kind of been relegated to, because I almost think her problem is that she's so beautiful that nobody takes her seriously, and that nobody gives her a whole lot to do in movies, and she doesn't have a ton more to do here. But I think that just being in this world that is so well written and well established allows her to kind of bring more acting bravado to it. I think she is a good actress, and I think she's going to have her day in court eventually, and she'll be able to actually prove herself. I recommend Rush. I think you have to kind of be into this stuff, but even if you're not, I think you can appreciate it on a filmmaking level.
See, I had the kind of a different, because I was just kind of into the character studies of both of them and kind of their ways about going about the world.
Yeah.
That's kind of what drew me in, not necessarily. I'm not into the race car part, and so I thought that it did deliver in that end.
Yeah.
I don't think that, I guess I wouldn't put the cautionary, well, you kind of have to be into this kind of a thing.
No, I don't think you have to be like a Formula One racing fanatic. But I think it's, I don't know if a person, I don't know. It's, for me, it just wasn't a movie that I could fall in love with. I definitely see it as totally solid. I pretty much find no fault in it. Other than maybe some of the racing scenes are a little over-edited for my taste. I think I maybe would like to see a little bit more a little bit more in general, just like open up the scene a little bit and let's see like the relation of where the cars are with each other. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes unless they show a scoreboard. But other than that, I think it's a totally solid film.
Agreed. No, I do have some of my, I have kind of a similar reaction though too. I'm just kind of like, oh yeah, it was good movie.
Yeah.
And then that was it. There's not like a whole lot of, there's not a love affair with
it. Yeah. It's as good of a movie as you should expect from a director like Ron Howard, who's been working as long as he has. He has no excuse to make any movie less good than this.
Yeah.
It's just as good as it needs to be.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you want me to give you another one-word answer, and you can keep going?
Or... No, I'm good.
Okay, good. Good to hear. Now we can move on to our next, our Netflix homework.
Yeah.
And unless you have anything else to say.
I
don't. I'm pretty much done.
Yeah, I have nothing else to say about Rush.
Okay, good. Good, good. So, as Cassidy said earlier, Upstream Color was the film that he assigned me.
Your makeup work.
Yeah, my makeup work. I'm not really sure how do I get into this.
Yeah, I maybe should have actually changed this order. So,
no, it's okay. I think I can abbreviate it.
Okay, go for it.
A Hispanic fellow puts a worm in a girl's head, and I'm going to tell you what literally happens. Puts a worm in this girl's head so that she'll do his whole beck and call, and he gets her to give away her house and all of her possessions and all that kind of good stuff and get her fired. And so, but this worm, however, happens to, as it goes back to nature, like, basically, to get the worm out, they have to pull it out and replace, like, a part of her skin with pig skin.
Hmm.
And that, basically, that graft makes this symbiotic, like, link between the pig and the human being. And basically, this link goes throughout, and basically another person who had a similar thing, I'm going to assume, happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of fall in love just as the pigs did. That's pretty much what happens. That's what literally happens in the film. But that's not what the film is about at all.
Mm-hmm.
The film is built by Sean Carruth, who we watched his film earlier on a Netflix homework as well.
Primer.
Yeah, Primer. He's something very impressive about this movie when it was coming out was that he was the producer, director, writer. And he also did the marketing himself, so he didn't bring it to a big studio and say, mm-hmm. hey, put this out. He toured it around and bring it to different places.
Yeah.
At his beck and call and at his whims, which is very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. He also wrote the score. But,
yes. he's a one-man movie.
Yeah.
This is a very good follow-up. Definitely not a sophomore slump. I would say that he goes from, you know, from a 6 to an 11. The film definitely delivers. It's a little strange. He's definitely playing in a Terrence Malick, kind of movie making.
Yeah. Style. Sort of tone. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do like that he still kind of played with the strange science fiction, macro level biology kind of weirdness.
Yeah.
That he did. I did also, even though the worm sounds ridiculous, they do have parasites that literally take over their host.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would make that work. I don't know if there's real science behind that, but it does have some basis in that. But what the film is, I mean, well, I watched this maybe like an hour ago, mm-hmm. so I'm still processing halfway what it's about, but it really seems like it's about what people, about their, for me anyways, what I picked up on was the relationship stuff and how you have this weird melding in your life sometimes,
mm-hmm.
when you're with somebody for so long, like they kept fighting about whose memories was who.
Mm-hmm.
No, that was my childhood. No, that was my childhood memory.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of became about, you know, when worlds kind of grow together in that sense.
Yeah.
And maybe, I don't know, there might have been stuff about nature in there too. I'm still kind of processing.
No.
So
and
why don't you tell me what the movie's about, Cassie?
And it's a movie that you can process for as long as you care to. Because it is, nothing about this movie is obvious. And nothing about this movie is spoon-fed, either thematically or narratively. It's a very difficult film, on a lot of levels. And it's certainly a movie that I feel like you have to pay full attention. You have to be alert. You have to be very, intellectually curious for this type of material. And I think it's a movie that requires repeat viewings. Not only, rewards and repeat viewings, but requires, because there's a lot of detail that I didn't get until the second time I saw this movie. And a lot of it had to do with the emotional thread of the movie, which I think is actually very prominent, which is different from Primer. Primer was a very, complicated narrative as well, and it had this kind of puzzle box structure in a similar way. But that movie was much more of a technical, screenplay, where this one is a lot more of an emotional screenplay and a lot more about interiorities, and a lot more about their characters.
Agreed.
I think this is by far the best film of the year for my money. And I sincerely doubt I'm going to see something better, by the end of the year.
Oh.
I think this is one of the most original things I've seen in forever. And I think that the way he uses filmmaking here is, considering this is only a second film, coming off of a very strong first film, I think this is, masterful filmmaking. And it's one of the few movies I've seen, where I look at it and I say, this story could only exist as a film. It couldn't be a novel. It couldn't be, a comic book. It couldn't be a video game. It couldn't be, you know, a campfire story, whatever. It only works as a film. And a lot of that has to do with the way that he, introduces score, the way that music and the sound design, is doing storytelling as well. It's not just there as background or as mood, filler. It's there as part of a way to, you know, there's narrative cues as what the music and the sound design is doing. I think the performances by Amy Simons and Carruth as one of the main characters, is really affecting. And his performance as an actor, is greatly increased from where he was in Primer.
I would think also the dialogue's a little more polished.
It is. Well, it's not a dialogue driven movie, but.
No, but it is, it's less flat when it's,
yeah. And it's a lot less expository too. There's a lot of Primer where it's trying to explain things to the audience because it is so dense. But in this movie, he doesn't do that. You have your little, the way you understood the order of events, at the top of your review, and mine differs a little bit, but I don't think either of us are wrong. Okay. There is a lot of weird, the conceit of this movie is very bizarre, and it's very kind of surreal. But I think what it's getting down to is humanity, and I think what it's getting down to is what is a person without memories? If you strip all of that away, if you take down all the layers of how we, define ourselves by our experiences, and you don't have that anymore, then are you still a person? And the only way that we can really reconcile that is when we meet somebody and when we fall in love. But, and it kind of does this in this very symbolic expressionistic way. I really can't say enough good things about this movie. I think it's one of those films that is going to be discovered, on a grander scale down the road. And I think it's going to be a film that's going to be studied because of how, advanced, and forward thinking the actual filmmaking is and the storytelling. I'm glad you saw it.
No, No, I did enjoy it. It is kind of a muncher. You have to munch on it quite a bit.
Yeah.
I agree with you for the most part. I do think it could be a novel or a few other things. I don't know if it's...
You could tell the story.
For me.
You could tell the story, but I don't think it would affect you,
you
the same
get the
way.
Whole experience. No, no, I think you'd have to get into it differently, and I think it'd be a strange journey.
Yeah.
I think that it's developed very well. If this was based on a book, maybe the movie would be better than the book. But there's a lot of strands to go from, and there's a lot of material there. I think it's very much in conversations with something like Tree of Life or 2001 Space Odyssey, for sure.
Yes.
It definitely doesn't, I wouldn't say that it expands the whole universe, but it does go to, it takes basically a drama kind of almost situation and expands it to a more environmentally impactful.
Yeah. A more universal kind
yes,
of experience.
Narrative, exactly. Yeah. I mean, like I said, they kind of travel from ours to a macro to a micro. I mean that in more of the science end.
Yeah.
And so it's a very complex and, kudos to him. And like I said, I think you're right. Specifically with the studying, and I would like to see some of the, numbers and stuff like that for his personal, marketing and all that kind of stuff.
How he was able
to, word of mouth.
How much he was able to make off of it. Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, it is interesting because we talked about before at one point, we talked about a DIY.
Yeah.
Because it is like, we know that there is something going on with the film industry that's not quite working. Is this a way for younger, talented filmmakers to break that a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to go back to almost kind of an exploitation almost kind of way? Not exploitation as like the material, but as in
the roadshow.
Certain theaters get it. Yeah, the roadshow kind of aspect.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, the economics behind this movie and how he decided to tour it is interesting, and I think it's really the only way this movie would have been able to be made. Because I think it's so dense and hard to describe and hard to market that I don't think a studio would have had faith in it, to be honest. But
well, especially from such a young,
young and somewhat an inexperienced director. Although, you know, he is a well liked director in certain circles. But I almost feel like that conversation is distracting from the actual film, which I think is unparalleled as far as a young director just making that kind of filmmaking so early in his career.
There is much to be said about that. Again, I for me, this isn't a film that you walk off from an hour from and then try to review it.
Yeah.
For me personally, which this has been an interesting experiment in watching very complicated and then trying to say something intelligent about it, which I don't think I've gotten to, but you know, I am interested in all the other stuff too, but you're right. No, it's a great film in and of itself. Besides all the interesting other, detaches of it.
Yeah. It was very.
Oh, I will say this too, the cinematography.
Oh,
I thought was a lot better.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Especially separated from Primer to this one.
And it's a very different kind of science fiction film because Primer, is a time travel film, and it uses its budget really wisely, but it has kind of this low-tech, high-tech thing, whereas this movie is more, like you said, biological, and there's almost aspects of it, it's almost Cronenbergian.
It's a lot of, yeah, I definitely, you can feel like different influences spilling into the film itself.
Yeah.
But
it never feels pastiche.
I don't think it evokes, no.
Yeah.
I'd even say kind of in, palette, I would say he evokes a little bit of Alfred Hitchcock, because he is so specific with his color, and you can see he's very specific with his color.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you compare the two films he's already made.
Yeah.
I hope he keeps in this vein. I don't know if I'll be able to understand his third film though, if he keeps up in this.
He has to outdo himself.
Yeah. Please don't outdo yourself. Do like a nice little, like just, you know, something on the level.
I want to just, if I were a producer, I would let him do whatever he wanted at this point. I think with that amount of talent, it shouldn't be ignored. But yeah, so I got to quit gushing because we got to finish the show eventually.
Yeah.
What are you going to assign me for next week?
I'm going to assign you, this, we're starting our horror month.
Yes.
So
all of October.
I will be, yes, all of October we'll be watching. I'm going to be assigning you the movie The Pact.
Okay, P-A-C-T?
Correct.
All right. And you've seen this already? You have not?
I have not. It was recommended to me by some people, and I haven't gotten around to it, and this is my chance. So.
All right, sounds good. And if anybody who's listening to the show has anything to say about any of the movies we've talked about today, Don John, Rush, Upstream Color, or The Pact, if you've seen it already and you want to put in your 2 cents before we review it next week, get a hold of us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also give us any comments or questions for the show. You can also get in contact to us through our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can also subscribe to us and write us a review at our iTunes. Just go to the iTunes store or podcast, Jabber on the Drone. You should be able to find us and subscribe. You can also subscribe to us or just listen to us via streaming at our Podbean archives, which is jabberinthedrone.podbean.com, where you can also find our RSS feed. You can also read my weekly reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, where you can also leave comments if you so wish. You can read my movie column that I do for the MacGuffin podcast out of Seattle. I have nothing to do with their audio or video casts, but I do occasionally provide content for them. You can find that at mcguff.in, and I should be under the authors as Cassidy Robinson. And Richard, you can find Rotting at the Bottom of the River, releasing strange inks into the orchid.
Mm-hmm. That's usually what I do on the weekends.
Yeah.
So.
No big deal.
All right. Yeah, no big deal. No biggie.
Otherwise, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay. See you later.
Bye.